The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the Public Accounts Committee to order. This morning we have with us the Departments of Fisheries and Aquaculture and also the Department of Agriculture. We're going to be discussing export development. I'd like to remind everyone to place their phones on silent so we don't have interruptions. We'll start with introductions, beginning with Mr. McGuire.
Brendan McGuire, Halifax Atlantic. Good morning.
Good morning. MLA Suzanne Lonas-Croft, Lunenburg.
Bill Horn, MLA for Waverly Fall River Beaver Bank, filling in for, Chuck Porter.
Yoakum Strong, Halifax, Pictou.
Good morning. Welcome. My name is Tim Houston. I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning. Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
Good morning. Lenore Zan, Truro, Bible Hill, Millbrook, Salmon River. Welcome.
I'm Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness, your chair. We also have with us Mr. Spicer from the Auditor General's office.
Terry Spicer, Deputy Auditor General.
And our witnesses today, Mr. Osborne, we'll start with you for an introduction.
Bruce Osborne, Executive Director, Nova Scotia Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture.
Frank Dunn, Deputy Minister, Department of Agriculture and the Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture.
Good morning, Loretta Robichaud, Senior Director for Agriculture and Food Operations, Department of Agriculture.
Ernest Walker, Senior Director of Policy and Corporate Services for Agriculture and Fisheries and Aquaculture.
And Mr. Dunn, you can now begin with opening comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to you and to committee members. Thank you for inviting us to join you today. I would like to give a brief introduction to the department staff, just beyond names and positions, just so that folks know who they are. Bruce Osborne is the Executive Director of Fisheries with the Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture. Bruce has a Bachelor of Science in Biology and a Master's in Marine Management. He has worked in fisheries and aquaculture and economic development and has been Executive Director for more than 2 years. And for you, Mr. Chair, if we get into details on fisheries questions, I'll be looking to Mr. Osborne perhaps to help me out on some of the answers. Loretta Robichaud is the Senior Director of Agriculture and Food Operations with the Department of Agriculture. Loretta has a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture from the Nova Scotia Agriculture College, and she also has a Master's of Public Administration from Dalhousie, and she's worked with the Department of Agriculture and other public service fields for over 28 years. So she's my go-to person on the ag questions. Ernest Walker is our Senior Director of Policy and Corporate Services for both of our departments. Ernest has responsibility for policy planning, corporate services, and programs. He has a Master's of Public Administration from Dalhousie University and has worked in Nova Scotia Public Service with a variety of departments for over 26 years. Once again, thank you for having us here today. Today's discussion comes at an exciting time for our departments and for the province. It's no secret to anyone that in this room that Nova Scotia is Canada's seafood leader. In 2016, we exported over $1.8 billion of seafood to markets around the world. Top seafood exports in order are lobster, crab, scallops, and shrimp. For the second year in a row, we sold more seafood in the world than any other province in Canada, and we're very close to a third of all seafood exports from Canada. This is something that Nova Scotia should be very proud about. It's a sign of the leadership that industry is showing and looking for new and innovative ways to supply global markets. It is also a sign that our future is tied to exports of seafood products. Our traditions are steeped in the fishery. Our economy sees significant benefits because of our ocean advantage, clean, clear water, and the ability to sustainably harvest from these waters. We know how to supply global markets with top quality seafood, and our fish harvesters, seafood processors, and exporting companies are doing it successfully every day. From here, we are reaching markets in the United States, Europe, and Asia, and doing it in record times, delivering high quality, fresh, and processed premium Nova Scotia seafood to a hungry world. The hard work of industry, along with the government's commitment to supporting innovation and export market development, is what helped us reach $1 billion in seafood exports in 2016. It's a remarkable achievement, and I can't say enough to thank our seafood harvesters, processors, and exporters for making this possible. They have made us Canada's leader in seafood exports and have met the challenge of the One Nova Scotia report to double our exports within 10 years. To continue to grow, we receive from seafood exports, we have launched a Nova Scotia international seafood brand. I was with the minister just last week in the Seafood Expo in Boston, where we showcased the new brand to the largest seafood show on the continent. I can tell you that the response was positive, enthusiastic from exporters and buyers at the show. Our new brand will help give Nova Scotia a competitive advantage in key global markets and communicate a clear message about our seafood, its exceptional taste and premium quality. Aquaculture is also part of our success story. Valued at $55 million in 2015, it's another form of seafood production that fits with our history and promises a bright future for our rural communities. Government has been moving forward carefully and deliberately to create an environment where aquaculture can develop safely and sustainably. We have a progressive set of regulations that are among the robust in the world, and we started to engage with industry and Nova Scotians to help the industry grow. At this time, we're also supporting the growth of our $58 million sport fishery by undertaking work to restore wild populations of salmon and trout. It is also part of a long-term commitment by government and the angling community to restore river habitat. Last fall, in cooperation with the federal government and the Nova Scotia Salmon Association, we announced a river liming project on the West River Sheet Harbour that will mitigate the effects of acid rain and support restoration of trout and wild Atlantic salmon habitat on the river. Nova Scotia is also shaped by our agriculture industry. It is part of the story of our export success. with our farming and agri-food businesses undertaking innovation and continuing with global markets. Government is working with them to help achieve success through our programs and services and the expertise of our dedicated staff. Nova Scotia exported $350 million in agriculture products in 2016. Our blueberries, our apples, our processed food products and beverages are showing up on tables around the world. There are many examples of how we're innovating in order to open export markets to our agriculture sector. We're working with the Nova Scotia wild blueberry and wine sectors to develop a blueberry wine that can be sold in China as a premium product. We're supporting the export potential of our wine industry as part of the Vineyard and Wineries Expansion Program, $12 million committed over 4 years to support planting more grapes, product research and development, quality initiatives, and export market development. The wine sector is one in particular where there is tremendous potential for export growth. We're also working with the sector to help adapt and prepare for export success. Priania developed market readiness workshops to more than 40 participants in 4 locations across the province in the fall of 2016. They're also helping clients achieve international certifications that open opportunities in international markets and providing incubator space to help startups and to grow future exports. The apple industry growth and efficiency program is supporting the growth of our apple industry and apple growers as they continue to plant high-density orchards of premium fresh market varieties. Apples is a real success story. Their export value has increased more than 7 times, from approximately $1.9 million in 2005 to more than $15 million in 2016. Our approach to export development in both of our departments is consistent with the goal of One Nova Scotia to sustainably double our agriculture and seafood products within 10 years. So why are we doing this? Because we see the opportunities that are out there for Nova Scotia seafood and agriculture products, and because we see what it can mean for growing the economy in our coastal and rural communities. There's a booming demand for food thanks to an expanded global middle class, and this means great things and possibilities for our seafood and agriculture sectors. By 2015, global food demands will have risen by 70%. This is an opportunity we're working hard to take an advantage as the province. We're performing at a high level as our seafood exports are reaching markets, as are our agriculture products. The potential for success is great, whether in seafood or agriculture. We'll continue to focus on our deliberate, thoughtful approach that is focused on working with industry and promote innovation and sound decision making. So with those comments, Mr. Chair, I welcome questions.
Thank you. Mr. Houston, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opening comments. I do want to start with lobster. Atlantic Canada possesses almost a natural monopoly on our type of lobsters. That's an advantage we have for sure. I wonder, you mentioned the rise in exports of our lobster in dollar values. I wonder if you can say if the export value of lobster by pound is rising as well. So in other words, if you look back to 2013, our dollar was at par with the U.S. dollar. Now our dollar it's come down significantly. So it would be. So there's a natural advantage there too with our product and our currency that when you convert our sales to Canadian dollars, the number is going way up. I wonder, and many people say that's all that's happening. I wonder if you can say is the poundage of lobster that's being exported increasing?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll start and then I'll turn over to Mr. Osborne. As far as lobster is concerned, you're correct. The export price when it comes, or the export value of lobster is a combination of both volume sold and the differential between the exchange rate in the USA. I can tell you that our strategy around lobster in particular is one about growing the premium market. And I won't get into a whole lot of what we're doing right now, but I'm sure there'll be questions later around that. But our idea is to define a niche where we deliver high-quality lobster product at a premium price around the world. And I'll turn it over to
Mr. Just on a very specific question of if you have this statistic to hand on the poundage of lobster that's exported this year versus maybe a couple years ago.
Mr. Osborne?
If you don't have it to hand, maybe we can get it.
Yeah, I can get the provide the number later, the actual volume of export. It is down a little bit in 2016. I don't have the actual number. Landings figures for Nova Scotia lobster, Nova Scotia fish landings in general, are not available yet from DFO. So the most recent figures we have to work from would be 2015 as we look at landings.
So when we hear that the exports of lobster are increasing dramatically, the only thing, if you don't have the landings figures and you don't know the poundage, the only thing you can possibly attribute that to is the currency, right?
No, there's really three things when you look at those export values. There's the volume of landings, there's the currency, and there's price increases. All those factors attribute to the overall export value. Lobster prices increased a little bit last year, which helped offset some of the decrease. So we did see a continued growth last year in lobster export value, despite a small decrease in the volume of exports. That was offset, as you said, by
the
increase in price.
So the volume's down, but the overall prices are. I was curious. I was hearing that. I didn't know whether to believe it or not, but it sounds like it's true. And I was curious if you had the statistics. So we'll try and get those in time. Maybe I'll ask for the statistics of the actual volume. Now, you mentioned the Nova Scotia brand. So is it the case that at one point there was talk of lobster levy working in cooperation with our neighboring provinces? Is all that gone to the wayside? Are we going to do it our own here on marketing a Nova Scotia lobster?
Mr. Dunn.
Through you, Mr. Chair. So on the lobster levy, we have very much left it with the industry in Nova Scotia to decide how they want to proceed on the lobster levy. It's up to them. We see ourselves as a...
Well, the decision's kind of made. If we've decided to go with a Nova Scotia brand, I think that's how you referred to the product you were showcasing in Boston over the last couple of weeks. Was it called Nova Scotia brand?
That's correct.
So the Nova Scotia brand, that kind of closes the door on working with the neighboring provinces, does it not?
I would say not. The Nova Scotia brand also, part of the brand is an acknowledgement of the Canadian brand as well. The lobster levy per se may be used for other things other than a marketing product. We have left it to the industry in Nova Scotia to decide whether they want to enter into an agreement where there's a lobster levy on lobster.
So from the department's perspective, lobster levy or not, it's somebody else's decision, I guess, right? It's if industry wants to go ahead, but years are passing since the minister was talking about a lobster levy.
Yeah, it's working with the industry. To acknowledge what the industry wants. I see the department as more of an enabler. There has been legislative regulation changes made that would allow a levy if the industry so choose to go in that direction.
Okay. Are you, for our lobster grounds, very fertile lobster grounds, particularly in the area that I come from, are you concerned about invasive species in those lobster grounds, different types of crabs? Is it something that the department is concerned about, an invasive species endangering our native lobsters?
Mr. Osborne.
We're concerned about any threat to any of our commercial species.
Is there any specific invasive species that's threatening our lobsters at the moment that you're aware of?
No great concern of a particular species has been brought to my attention most recently. Certainly in the past, green crab has been identified, particularly from some in industry, as a potential predator, particularly on juvenile lobster. I would say to that as well that some recent federal announcements include funding for invasive species work. So we'll all be looking to how we can further do work to mitigate or prevent invasive species.
Okay, so there's some, potentially some federal. Is that from the new budget? Did they announce some funding for invasive species research, the feds?
It could be part of the new funding announcement.
Could be. Oh, the 300. Okay, so we don't know. So, okay, so it might be or it might not be. Okay, would that be something that you'd want to see included in there?
Yeah, we are always concerned about invasive species impacting our commercial fishery.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. I do want to talk about the new safety gear changes for it'll definitely impact the lobster fishery in Nova Scotia. And I know it's not you guys per se, but I'm curious to know where you're at on it. Like, obviously, some of the changes are good things. Job safety assessment, that's a good thing, right? The more training around first aid, these are good things. Survival suits, I kind of hear mixed on those. But the life raft requirement is an expensive requirement for our local fishers. And I'm just wondering where the department is on that, because if you have a lobster fisher that's going a mile from shore or 2 miles from shore, or even surrounded by 20 or 25 boats in very pretty close proximity, the requirement for a life raft is it's expensive, but it's onerous as well. I've actually talked to one guy who's going to shave some length off his boat because it's cheaper for him to do that than what where are you guys at on these new requirements? Are you totally supportive of them, or are you trying to work with the feds to make them a little more practical, or where's the department at?
So the rules that you're referring to are federal rules, Transport Canada rules. The department is actively involved in safety, working with industry through the Fishing Safety Committee of Nova Scotia. We've made significant commitments to that effort, working with them. There's a Safety Now strategy in place that has 33 recommendations, and our department is working with industry to implement those recommendations. We have four staff members that participate.
So you're working on the implementation. So are you working to change
on the
what's
safety
been pushed
on the
out?
Safety Now plan,
yeah,
which
so
is an industry committee.
Are you supportive of the recommendations that have been made all the way down to the life raft?
We support safety in the industry is very important. I don't have a comment on the specific federal regulations or the...
Okay, so you wouldn't say whether they've gone too far or not?
I don't have a comment on those federal regulations.
Maybe the deputy. The life raft in particular is a concern to a lot of fishers in Nova Scotia. It seems like it's a bit too much. Everyone wants a safe environment, for sure. I'm not disputing that. I'm just asking the question of whether the department feels that, let's talk about the life raft requirement, is gone too far, or is it fine? It's just a simple question. Department good with it?
Mr. Dunn?
I mean, I can say specifically around the life work requirement, I have not had discussions with staff around whether it's gone too far or not, and I think I'd reiterate what Mr. Osborne said is regardless, safety is extremely important in the industry, and it's important to the department as well.
Okay. On the what about the owner-operator policy? Is the department's position that the policy as it is now, is they're good with that? Would they defend that policy, or is the department, what's the department's thoughts on the owner-operator policy?
So we're supportive of an owner-operator policy.
Okay. Of the existing policy,
mm-hmm.
The way it is, yeah. You'd like to see it stay the way it is.
Correct.
Okay. We have a very successful charter tuna fishery starting in this province. Is there any thoughts to? Most people have a tag for a tuna. People who come up to tourists and go fishing, it'd be nice if they could kill a tuna as well. Is there any thoughts to trying to work with the charter fishery to see if there's more tags available, or what are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Osborne?
Sure. We do have a strong interest in developing sport fish fisheries, including marine sport fish such as bluefin tuna. We've been involved, staff in our department have been involved in helping develop that bluefin tuna charter business for a while. With respect to the how those tags are provided and the actual management within that fishery, that's primarily the federal government as well, Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And there are certain interactions around access to the resource between the commercial harvesters and the charter group. So I don't have a specific comment on around getting additional tags other than we would encourage those conversations to be had around the advisory committee tables where all those folks
sure. are I guess a lot of these, the crossover between the federal and the provincial is it's kind of like the Department of Education, the school boards. It's always like somebody else is supposed to deal with that. I guess as a general question I would ask, is it the department's responsibility to advocate for Nova Scotian fishers with the federal government, or is it the department's responsibility to just implement what the feds tell them to do? That's the question for the deputy, because it's important to all these issues. Is the department implementing what the feds want, or is the department meant to be pushing for Nova Scotia fishers?
Mr. Dunn?
So in general, I can say, there are very specific responsibilities and accountabilities that are laid out around what the federal government and what the provincial government do. That's one part of our job. I mean, the other part of our job, obviously, is to advocate for our fishers in Nova Scotia. And we have conversations with the federal government, particularly through Fisheries and Oceans, on many files to express, in some cases, our support, and in some cases, perhaps not our support when it comes to particular files. But like any government, at the end of the day, the federal government will decide what they want to do on their responsibilities, hopefully with informed input from Nova Scotia.
Okay. Now, hopefully some of those times when you disagree with them, you have been successful at change, and I do want – maybe we'll come back to that, but I'm kind of bumping the clock here, and I do want to talk about the mackerel fishery. The Atlantic Mackerel Advisory Committee is meeting in Halifax tomorrow, I think. I think this is a meeting where the minister will set the quota, I guess, for the next couple of years. Will you be representing at that meeting? Will you be at that meeting?
Mr. Osborne. Yep, so we will have staff at those meetings, yes.
Staff will
there's
be
local meetings, and then there's meetings in Quebec as well.
So who would somebody that's here today be at that meeting?
No.
Okay, so staff would be there. So fishers are worried that the quota will be cut. And they're worried that the quota will be cut based on science that they believe is either flawed or dated. Have you heard from mackerel fishers and mackerel buyers about their concerns about the quota and what's happening? So statistics that I've seen show the landings for mackerel this year are almost 20 times higher than what they were over the last couple of years. But yet the science is suggesting that mackerel is an endangered species. So the two things don't really jive. It's a lucrative fishery for this province. It'd be a shame to see the quota cut. And I don't know if you've been in contact with Ryan Langell. Ryan's a young entrepreneur. He's in his sixth year of growing a fish buying business. In 2012, he sold 70,000 pounds of mackerel. Compared to last year where he sold 1.7 million pounds. And he's growing a business. He's become a bit of an expert on the mackerel fishery. Is this somebody who you could advocate for to appear at some of these meetings where the quota is being set? I think he's asked specifically if he can be at those meetings tomorrow. I know none of you guys are going, but staff is going. Could you get Ryan at that meeting tomorrow to represent the mackerel fishery?
Mr. Dunn?
A couple of questions there, Mr. Chair. With regards to whether we've met with Ryan Langell, we have. I've met with him. The minister's met with him. I believe Bruce has as well.
Does it make sense what he's saying?
Well, we're supportive, and we've actually had staff work with him to try to facilitate ensuring that the federal government understands what his concerns are. I guess from an unbiased opinion, there's a difference in opinion around the science with regards to the mackerel stock. And so we've had our groundfish advisor work with him, made some contact with the federal government. I know that that I've actually had some, been copied on some correspondence that Mr. Langille has made as late as this morning about attending that meeting. It is a DFO meeting, so I can't see us being able to have the ability to have him added on to the meeting. I know he's asked DFO. I don't know if he's received a reply.
So this is the first year the mackerel fishery was ever closed, I think, certainly in recent memory, and possibly in history. And you understand why they're concerned. So the department itself will be at the meetings. Will the staff be taking? Will they be taking a position of this is there's lots of mackerel out there, folks, or will they be taking the position that the federal science says there's not many, so therefore there's not many? Where are you guys at on that?
Mr. Dunn?
It's important to the fishery.
I'll turn it over to Mr. Osborne in a second, but I think it's important for committee members to remember that when it comes to the fishery and whether a fishery is open or enclosed, that is not a responsibility of the province. So we talked a little bit about responsibilities and what the federal government may or may not be responsible for, and that is one that the federal government is responsible for. I would turn it over to Mr. Osborne with regards
but
to specific.
But if this meeting is going to set the quota, which I understand it is, that's an important fact. That's an important outcome of that meeting. Mm-hmm. And it's an important fishery. So I'm a little taken aback I don't want to demean the staff that will be there, but it's. I would have thought that might have elevated to your level, quite frankly, Deputy, that you'd be an interested stakeholder in that meeting and could go and at least the advanced position of some of the fishers that don't cut this quota on us. There's no reason to cut the quota, but that's a hard thing for staff to do. It's hard for staff to go and say the position of Nova Scotia is that this quota shouldn't be cut. So maybe that's not your position and the staff will go and listen intently. I don't know. But it seems like an important meeting to have in Halifax, but not be represented by the senior levels of the department. Am I missing something?
Mr. Dunn?
I think all I can, and maybe I'll perhaps ask Mr. Osborne to talk a bit about the process of the meeting and how the meeting operates, but, I can only...
I guess in the interest of time, will the quota be set tomorrow?
Mr. Osborne?
I'm not aware that the quota will be set tomorrow. Decisions around access are made by the federal minister when the minister decides. The meetings that are underway are a combination of science meetings and ultimately advisory meetings where opinions such as Mr. Langille's would be able to be put on the table as well as all the other stakeholders in the sector.
Except he can't go and put his opinion on the table.
He can certainly ask to go.
He's asked to go.
Yeah.
But he hasn't been supported by the department in that ask, I don't believe.
Order. Time has expired. We'll move to the NDP caucus. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. Export development definitely has a huge impact on our economy, and I know a lot of the attention has been around fisheries and making sure that our product gets out and about around the world, and to improve that is I think something that we all want to see here in the province. And it's not just the fisheries. I think you mentioned in your opening comments about potentials for blueberry wine, and so it's a topic that I think is important. I know governments of all stripes have recognized that here in Nova Scotia and across the country. I know the former provincial and former federal government partnered recently in 2012 with the Halifax Airport Authority to expand the runway to accommodate larger planes, cargo planes, to land, take off, and hopefully get our cargo out
further than our borders. Can you give us any indication on if that that investment has paid off? Have we seen an increase in larger cargo planes and the ability for us to get some of our products to market over the last, I think it was 2012 when it officially opened, I believe, or somewhere around there. But have you seen the increase in those larger planes and the ability to get our products out of the province into export market?
Mr. Dunn?
I think I would start by saying, it's critical to have these larger planes being able to export our seafood products around the world because time is important and quality is important. And so the quicker that we can export our products to other markets around the world, the better off we are. With regard specifically to your question, maybe what I'll do is just give you some numbers for our top four exports. So our number one export is lobster, and if you look at the change in our export value from 2012 to 2016, we've increased by 154%, and so that's from about $375 million in 2012. We're now up close to $1 billion on lobster. So when you talk about these large cargo planes, I would suggest that the majority of the seafood that's being exported out of those large cargo planes is lobster. But just quickly on crab, we've seen an increase of 68% from 133 to 225. On scallops, we've seen an increase of 43%. From 98 million to 140 million. And on the shrimp, we've seen an increase of 36% from 83 million to 112.
Excellent. Thank you for that. So that $5 million investment, I think, paid off. I was very proud to be part of the government to recognize that. And I hope the current government, recognizes the importance of making sure that getting our product to the market is a top priority. What other avenues? So, of course, we have trains, trucks, shipping. What other areas have the government? Has there been any concentration on trying to improve the ability to export other than air cargo over the last number of years? Has there been any attention to the other areas of transportation?
Mr. Osborne?
Sure, and just to touch on the air freight a little bit there, the we do play a role in helping the airport folks understand the seafood industry and its needs, and we're in regular contact providing them with information, statistics, anything they need really to try and attract that lift. I think one of the most important things as a department that we can do in supporting that is building the level of those exports, and then the carriers will look to establish there. So that's primarily the two roles that we play with air. We also have done work and support companies that were looking at a live shipment, particularly of shellfish. And these are companies like BioInnovation. In the past, there was another company called Aqualife that was around. So these are technical systems to transport shellfish longer distances, either on trucks or on cargo ships.
Great, thank you. I know there's, margins are slim, and often when you need to transport long distances, so every dollar counts. And I know that there's been some talk recently on the federal level about privatizing our airports, which to me means entering a profit-driven kind of philosophy to running our airports, which can be damaging, I think, especially if we're trying to attract more carriers to Halifax, for example. Has there been any discussion in your department to ensure that the federal government recognizes that, there's been significant investment not only provincially but federally in our airport to ensure that we can hopefully increase market access to the market, that privatization could could play a role in hurting our ability to attract more carriers. So has there been any discussion on your level? If not, shouldn't there be? If you represent, you know, the sheer numbers that you've just given us shows that that investment in the airport is so important. So has there been any discussion on the possibility of privatization of the airports across the country, which I assume Halifax would be one they would be looking at?
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, there hasn't been a discussion with me as Deputy of Agriculture or Fisheries. I would suggest that it may be a question best put to the Deputy of Business or RGA, little outside Fisheries and Agriculture's.
Well, I respect that, and I know others within government may be looking at that, but you represent an important industry, and I feel that if it does come from your department and your concern, then people will start paying attention to this instead of paying attention to it after the federal government makes a decision. In my opinion, I think you're in a perfect role to at least put up a flag to say, we should really look at this. Potentially, it could have an impact on the area that you represent as deputy. And I understand that, you know, next week they could move you out of here. But I think as a department, I think you're well within. I think the role that you play to put a flag. So my request would be: would you or could you make sure that somebody within the department maybe has a discussion on a broader sense with your counterparts, if it's business or even the Premier, in my mind, and make sure that the Premier knows that, listen, this is something that could impact our department and the people that we serve. So maybe that's an ask. I don't know if there's an answer to that or we'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, I can say to the member that I'll have conversation with my colleagues in some other departments.
Excellent. I think, you know, I understand completely that it's going to be a federal decision, but there'll be implications, I think, and that's just one that I know that we've thought about over the last little while. I know over the last number of years, the access to Southern Asia has been important. It's an important market. I know Premier Dexter has taken trade missions, has gone on trade missions. I know Premier McNeil has also gone to make sure that we open up that market, and I think it's an important one. But our largest trading partner definitely is to the south of us with the U.S. So with a lot of emphasis on Asia, what has been the existing relationship or the current relationship with our neighbors to the south in the U.S., especially since the new president come aboard in the fall? What can you say about that relationship and the access to that market? And are you working and trying to make sure that our products get down to the U.S. in a timely manner, because they are so close?
Mr. Dunn.
So absolutely, we're monitoring the situation in the United States. I can say that our seafood exports to the States make up about 56% of our exports, and on the agriculture side, almost 59%, so a substantial amount. It is I think the best way to describe it is a concern with the current administration. Keep in mind that this is a country-to-country situation. I know that Global Affairs Canada has had many conversations with the U.S. administration. Our liaison with Global Affairs Canada is our IGA department, and they have reached out to us on numerous occasions, whether it's a seafood file or whether it's an agriculture file. And so, you know, work is ongoing, and I have not heard anything directly out of the U.S. that at least concerns me now.
Okay, and of course, it's the it could just come out of left field by the manner of how the president signs these orders every other day, and
and shows everybody on TV that what he's done that day. So it's, I hope that they recognize the closer relationship. I know a lot of the members in the House have been involved with CSG, Council of State Governments, the Eastern Regional Conference. And that's, of course, Eastern Seaboard states and the Canadian provinces on the east working together, on a level that kind of doesn't include the federal governments on both parts. And it seems like a lot of good work has taken place. So a great opportunity to make sure that we work, in a timely way to make sure that the federal governments don't mess things up when they bring policy in. And we've seen a number of examples of that over the years. One of the other areas is of concern is the Canadian-EU Trade Agreement, or CETA. What impact will that have on fisheries and agriculture exports here in the province? Have you done an evaluation on what the impact would be for those products?
Mr. Dunn?
It will have a positive impact on both the seafood side and the fishery side. I know that the European Union signed off on the agreement in February. It's the plan now that the federal government will sign off on it very soon, end of March, early April. I can tell you that the new agreement will reduce tariffs on over 90% of the products that we ship into the European Union, both on a seafood side and on a an agriculture side. And in fact, I've seen information which I can provide to you if you'd like, which will actually show the number of tariffs, the amount of the tariff, and what the reduction will be. So very positive. It'll be cheaper for us to ship our goods into European Union.
Yeah, that'd be very useful if you could provide the committee with that. But on the flip side, imports. And I know dairy, for example, cheese, milk, I know that there's concerns in the industry around the impact, potential impact. What kind of evaluation have you done on the impact in the dairy industry, and to what degree will the federal government help our industry here in Nova Scotia?
Mr. Walker.
Yeah, so there's been a fair amount of discussion with the federal government around the impacts on the supply managed sector, and of course with the CETA agreement, cheese is the most impacted. So I know the federal government has announced some measures to support processing support for the dairy and cheese sector.
Okay. Because I know that I love cheese, but I love our economy growing and those local farmers to make sure that they're taken care of, and I hope that the province stands strongly behind them. I know we can turn to the 90% of our reduction tariffs on exports, but imports could hurt our economy also. I want to turn quickly to I think there was mention of the recommendations around the Fisheries Safety Committee of Nova Scotia. I think there are 33 of them, I believe. I know my colleague, Sterling Bellevaux, comes from the industry and recently has talked about the need to look at safety and personal flotation devices. Is any of those recommendations, do they discuss the PFDs in any way of changing the requirements that currently are in place for safety on vessels?
Mr. Osborne.
We can provide you with a full list of the 33 recommendations, but I can say specifically that work done by that committee, industry, and life preserver companies, the companies that manufacture those goods, have worked together to prototype and trial life-saving equipment that is actually workable and feasible aboard fishing vessels. As you may be aware, for a number of years, industry expressed concern that the available equipment just didn't meet their needs And so by working together with a number of manufacturers, there is now equipment that works well. I believe it will be an ongoing improvement process that as additional things are found, they will continue to be approved. So there's been a lot of work done on making sure that the equipment suits the work that's being done on the back of boats.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, I hope, is that the department's open to changes to those regulations, those policies, legislation, if need be, in the future, as we look at this this issue, and we know the tragic cases that we've seen over the last number of years, and it always unfortunately always brings up the discussion around personal flotation devices. So I would assume that the government, the department's willing to look at potential changes of the policies or the regulations around personal flotation device in the future.
Mr. Osborne?
I think everybody's interested in safety and whatever would benefit safety for the industry is what the department would support.
Excellent.
And as I said, we work through the industry committee and with federal government to implement those recommendations.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I know my colleague will be glad to hear that also. Go to the fisheries now. The Nova Scotia Seafood Alliance has recently asked the government to stop issuing new buyer and processor licenses. And I know the minister hasn't shut the door on it. So where is the department, where is the minister on that request from the Seafood Alliance?
Mr. Dunn?
Mr. Chair, the member is talking about buyer and processing licenses in Nova Scotia, and the Seafood Alliance, which used to be the fish packers of Nova Scotia, has stated their position. We have not made a decision one way or another on any license policy changes. We're in early days with discussion on this matter, and as you would appreciate, there are those in the industry that would have another view on that statement. So at this stage of the game, the department's being very open-minded. We want to have discussions with numerous stakeholders so that we can be best informed.
Are you aware of that request in the past? Is this something that is just recent, or have they asked in the past about tightening up and maybe not issuing as many licenses that we've seen in the past?
Mr. Dunn?
I have not heard that request since I've been at Fisheries, although I have not been there very long, so I'd look to Mr. Osborne, who's been there slightly longer than I have.
Well, I know I only have 1 minute. There has been asked in the past, and the ministers have closed the door pretty quick, realizing the impact. So we're just a bit concerned that the door hasn't been closed, and I hope that the department takes every effort to make sure that they engage those who will be affected if any decision like this has been made. And I think there's a negative impact on the industry if the door is left open too long. So I would encourage the department and the minister to make a decision either to close the door and lock it, put a deadbolt on it, or do what the government's going to do. So thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. The time is just expiring. Mr. McGuire.
Thank you for coming here today. I just had a few questions in regards to aquaculture. You said that we're at $55 million. Is that right?
Mr. Dunn?
That's correct.
Are we maxed out? And if so, where do we go from here? And if not, what is the department's goal for industry growth?
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, through you, I can say that we are not maxed out. We talked a lot about so far this morning about the commercial fishery. We also have a goal on the aquaculture side to grow the aquaculture industry because we believe that it's a strong economic driver in coastal rural communities in Nova Scotia. Our goal is to reach a value of somewhere around $280 million. Currently, we are not accepting new applications for salmon in particular. We have, I guess, best described it as being cautious and deliberate as we move forward in the aquaculture industry to ensure that everyone in the sector, both those that are positive with regards to the economy and those that have some concerns around how the sector may impact the environment. We've been very deliberate in addressing both of those concerns as best we can. As mentioned, the robust regulations that we have in place for the aquaculture sector. I can tell you that the Minister has a regulatory review advisory committee that's made up of not only business but other stakeholders, including NGOs, to advise him when those regulations were formed. I can tell you that the Minister also has a science advisory committee on aquaculture, which is chaired by William Hatcher, who's a professor out of Cape Breton. And we recently have just appointed a third-party review panel, which will actually look at applications for both amendments to existing licenses and applications for new applications as we move forward.
So you mentioned concerns, particularly around environment. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And also, if there is an expansion of the salmon aquaculture industry, what kind of impact do you see it having on rural Nova Scotia economically, but also what kind of impact does it have on the small fishing communities that rely heavily on lobster and other ground fish? Also, we've seen examples, particularly in Scotland and Australia, where the aquaculture industry is working closely with the inshore fishing groups and also with the local communities. So they have buy-in from both stakeholders. Are we looking at a model like that? I know that's a couple of questions, but
Mr. Chair, I'll attempt to answer some of them and then maybe perhaps turn it over to Mr. Osborne for some more detail. You know, the department believes totally that we can have a aquaculture development in the province and the coastal communities that can coexist with, I think you referred to the commercial lobster fishery. We believe we can. We believe there's great opportunity.
Is there models of that? Is there models, like, have you looked at the different industries from around the world and see how they how their relationship is with the local ground fisheries?
We have, and perhaps Mr. Osborne can give a little more detail.
Mr. Osborne?
Yes, we have, and in particular, during the formation of the new regulations, a lot of effort was put in to look at how other jurisdictions regulate their industry and how they interact. Most recently, the Minister and our Director of Aquaculture were in New Zealand and Australia and visited with both industry and government people to see how it works, how their system works. Every system has pros and cons, so it's important to understand those and also how those systems might reflect back home. Part of the earlier question that you asked was about impacts, and the Deputy mentioned our view of coexistence, and we certainly do see that in Atlantic Canada. We've seen a significant increase in both commercial fisheries as well as aquaculture throughout the region over the last couple of decades. So we certainly do believe that the two can coexist. With specific reference to lobster, the department and the minister has stated that the approach is a science-based approach. So we will use science, and the science committee is there to help the department and the regulatory committee review science to make fact-based decisions around issues of interactions or impacts. One of the things that the department has done very specifically looking at the lobster interaction question has been to fund some work with the University of St. Anne to look specifically at the lobster question and work very directly with lobster harvesters to first, I think, to find out what actually their concerns are and then look to put the science in place to start answering some of those questions.
So I'm just going to use and we've had this discussion before around a gentleman that was lived in just down the street from me, Brian Blanchard, who is an expert on aquaculture. He's been around for a long, long time. Just recently packed his bags and moved to New Zealand. Brian and I had a discussion over Christmas about the difference with regards to how the public views aquaculture. In New Zealand or Australia, actually, sorry, I think it's Australia. I apologize. And here. How do we get that buy-in? Especially, I mean, you keep saying, like, you know, we're going to use science. But if the science is coming from government, inevitably there's going to be people that don't believe that science. They may think that they're just trying to, you know, pad their own tax pockets. So how do we get the buy-in from communities and say, you know, this is working, this is how it's done, and this, I mean, ultimately, if we're going to do this, this has to be safe and has to be sustainable, and we don't want to see an impact to our groundfish industry. So how do we do that and convince communities like some of these other jurisdictions have done? What's your plan?
So, Mr. Chair, through you, there's a couple things I think we can do, and this is a file that actually I'm quite interested in, and you know, in my mind, many commodities that we use, we develop in Nova Scotia, not just aquaculture, but a series of natural resources commodities, it's a similar question. And, you know, in my mind, there's a two-pronged approach to this. And one is the education piece, right? It's educating the general public, communities where aquaculture facilities may be. Around exactly, you know, what is an aquaculture facility and how does it impact the environment and, you know, what are the protocols and safeguards that we have in place to ensure that, you know, some concerns around the environment are put in place. Right? Equally important, I believe, is the public trust piece, which has been in the news a lot lately. Perhaps not those words, public trust. But it is about not just government, in fact, I would say more so industry, but it is about government and industry working together to ensure that that public trust is there with the communities that they're involved with every day. And a big part of that is communication, engagement with local residents that are impacted on a day-to-day basis, and it's not an easy slog sometimes. But in my mind, it's a two-pronged approach. It's that approach of dealing with the community and developing that level of trust, and also an education process so that folks truly understand what it's meant when you talk about an aquaculture business or endeavor.
I want to shift gears for a second, and I heard from local fishers about potential federal policy change around cusk and the impact that that could have on the ground fisheries. Can we get into that? I'd like to know where we're at on that, how those discussions have evolved. Did you listen to the local Nova Scotia fishers and advocate on their behalf, or did you kind of side with the government, the federal government, on this? Because it does have a potential to have a fairly large impact on our lobsters in particular. So,
Mr. Osborne?
Certainly, cusk is an important issue in the lobster fishery, and there's been concerns for some time around potential listing of Cusk, and a lot of discussion has gone on around that. The issue for the lobster fishery is one of bycatch. And a lot of questions have been raised around the science that's used to assess the level of the Cusk stocks. And in reference to an earlier question, the department's role, how we look at these things, is it's a provincial interest that we look at. And we look at the best available science. We look at the questions about that science, if there are questions about it. We look at the economic impact to the province. And the positions that we take are a combination of all of those things. In looking at the Cusk question, there were credible questions about the Cusk assessment. The industry certainly raised a lot of questions about the numbers that the federal government was using. And the department, certainly in putting its view forward to the federal government, expressed some of those concerns, as well as expressed what the significant potential impact economically to the province could be if on the lobster fishery in particular, depending on what the federal government would do around protecting Cusk.
So the question is, where are we at on this? Has the federal government made a decision, and are you pleased, if they have, are you pleased with the decision they made? Do you think the fishers in Nova Scotia's interest has been adequately presented by your department, represented by your department?
I think the Nova Scotia, yes, I think Nova Scotia's economic interest, I mean, we also have a role to play with or an interest in Cusk as a species as well and sustainability. So we do need to take a balanced approach. I think the department was satisfied with the information that we received from industry and looking at science. And we were satisfied that there were credible questions to be asked around that science. I can get you an update on exactly where the federal, that is a federal government matter, where the federal government is at with respect to Cusk.
I suspect someone from the federal government is actually watching this because my phone just rang and it was someone from the federal government. So I suspect. I'd like to thank Tim for his 2 cents as usual.
Yeah. Order, please. Please continue with the questioning.
Appreciate if you'd keep the chirping to a minimum also, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
When it comes to the lobster levy, this was a contentious issue when it was first introduced, and I certainly heard a lot about it locally. Do you feel that you adequately consulted with the fishers right across Nova Scotia? And is there any plans to impose this, or like you said earlier, are we just going to leave it up to the industry to decide where we're going to let them to self-regulate this and go with it if they want, and if they don't, well, that's up to them.
Mr. Dunn?
Mr. Chair, through you, it would be the latter. We have no intention to impose a levy at this time, and it's in the hands of the industry to decide how they want to proceed.
Okay. And do you foresee any impact on our agriculture and fisheries with Trump's protectionism policies? Are you guys, do you have a plan in place in case we are negatively impacted by any policies that may be rolled out in the coming future?
Mr. Chair, through you, as I mentioned earlier, we don't have in particular direct contact with
Are you
those.
Speaking to the feds about this?
Yeah, we have been talking to the federal government about this, and you know, they're Global Affairs Canada dealing with you know, the Department of Commerce and their colleagues in the States have expressed our concern, you know, particularly around NAFTA and free trade and you know, the desire to ensure that that agreement continues. And, you know, we're always looking for ensuring that we can get the best deal possible when it comes to exports out of Canada in general and in specific exports with Nova Scotia. So ongoing dialogue through IGA, who deals with Global Affairs Canada on the file.
How much can be offset by the growth in the Asian market?
Mr. Chair, through you. So, it's no secret that, we talk about seafoods or agriculture projects that, the majority of our exports are into the States. That's not to say that there's not an opportunity here look at the Asian market. Not only from a fish or seafood perspective or an agriculture perspective, but the government in general has looked at a Nova Scotia-China economic growth strategy. I know the Premier has been there. So this is about looking at other markets and in some ways diversifying a little bit. Mr. Osborne had mentioned earlier that our minister has been to Asia on a number of occasions. We are dealing now with a company in China called Alibaba, who's a major online seller of product. And we are involved in a pilot project with three lobster processors in Nova Scotia. To deliver 300,000 live premium lobster through the Chinese market. And as I mentioned earlier, our key is premium product at a premium price. So we do see, and the middle class in Asia has expanded greatly in the last little while, and we see a lot of opportunity in Asia. So that's one example of where we're tapping into that market.
So what is your department? We've heard some good stories here today. And what is your department doing to promote these good news stories, whether it's the apples, the wine industry, the lobster, both locally, nationally, and internationally, aside from the new brand?
Sorry, I didn't get the last. Besides?
Besides the creation of this new brand that you've done, like what are you doing to show the world that we are leaders in these industries, and to have when it comes to apples, wine, and lobster, to have Nova Scotia on the forefront of their mind?
A couple questions there, maybe to be specific. I mean, on the lobster file or the seafood file in general, the new brand aside, we and staff attend numerous trade shows over the run of the year, marketing our product. I know that my minister has been a strong advocate of exporting Nova Scotia seafood and agriculture around the world, and he's actually visited these countries and takes a keen personal interest in advocating for Nova Scotia products. You had mentioned wine. Wine is, as I describe it, an industry that's at its infancy. $12 million program over 4 years to develop that industry. I can tell you that part of that money this year was $150,000 to start looking at export development. But it's not only the government that can promote our products. It's also the industry that can promote their products as well. On the ag side, in general, I can tell you that we have a close working relationship with Taste of Nova Scotia, which are strong supporters of
order. I'm sorry, time has expired. We'll move back to the PC caucus. Mr. Houston for 14 minutes.
Thank you. In 2016, there was about 24,000 hives used in the mostly in the blueberry industry, I guess, in the province. And this year, it's forecast that the required number of hives is much, much lower. In fact, I'm hearing that there's a lot of hives that will go unrented this year in the province. Is there a surplus of hives in the province for the coming year?
Mr. Dunn, we'll go with Ms. Robichaud.
Thank you, Chair. I wouldn't suggest that there's a surplus of hives in the province. Hives are used for two purposes, for honey production and for pollination. It is the added value of being able to rent your hive out for pollination that attracts additional revenue for the beekeepers. So we have been undergoing an expansion program in the province as the blueberry industry required additional pollination services. With the downturn in the price of blueberries, the requirement for the same number of hives for that industry is decreased this year, but that doesn't suggest that we have an overabundance of hives. It just means that they will not be rented out to the degree that they have been historically.
Okay, so there's and the province invested in getting more hives here through that pollination expansion program. I think it was about $1 million program. So the province made an investment to get more hives here, to have more hives available for pollination purposes. Mm-hmm. There's hives here that could pollinate that will go. You're saying there, you don't believe there's a surplus of hives for pollination purposes?
I'm suggesting that there's other uses for the hives. So if they're not utilized for pollination, it doesn't necessarily directly equate that we have a surplus.
Okay. Okay. So there's enough. Would you say there's enough hives in the province to meet the pollination requirements for the year?
For this current year, yes.
Okay. And do we have the small hive beetle in Nova Scotia?
We do not have any detection of small hive beetle in the province.
Okay. Do they have the small hive beetle in Ontario?
They do.
Okay. Did the department issue a permit to import hives into Nova Scotia to be used for pollination purposes for this year?
Applications are due by March 1st with the issuing of the permits later in the year. So there is an application before the department for the importation of hives, but there is no issuance of permit to date.
Okay. And do you suspect that permit will be issued under the... Is there a possibility that a permit could be issued for the importation of hives for the purpose of pollination in light of the fact, with the knowledge of the fact, that there is sufficient hives in the province to meet the pollination requirements, and in light of the fact that they would be imported from an area that's known to have the small hive beetle into our province, which does not. Is it possible that a permit could be issued under those circumstances to import hives? I see the deputy wants to answer.
Mr. Dunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could respond, and I think the honourable member is talking about some recent news media around importation of hives into Nova Scotia. And so, I guess to answer his question, yes, it's possible. If hives were imported in from Ontario, it would be a business decision from the applicant to do so. I know there was mentioned in the questions around the small hive beetle, and I can tell you that we have a import protocol around importing bees into the province. We're aware that there's a small hive beetle in Ontario. We have a bee expert which travels to Ontario when there is a plan to import hives into Nova Scotia. He's an expert in the field.
So, who pays for that? Who pays for that inspection? So, if a permit is approved, it sounds like it probably will be, to import hives into the province from an area that's known to have the small hive beetle, the hives are going to be inspected before they're trucked here, mm-hmm. and they're going to be inspected, by the sounds of it, by our bee expert. Who's going to pay for that?
It would be the Department of Agriculture.
Okay. Would that be not part of the application? Shouldn't that be part of the application process, that the applicant should be able to kind of certify that that at their cost, that it wouldn't put our bee colony at risk of the small hive beetle? How much will it cost the department to have those hives inspected before they're shipped here?
Ms. Robichaud?
The arrangement for payment is through our partnership with the Wild Blueberry Producers Association, who's also supportive of hives coming into the province. And the cost for this year's inspection is $8,000, which will see four inspectors go to Ontario, two from government and two from industry.
Okay. But is it okay with you that the taxpayers pay for that in light of the fact that there's sufficient hives here to pollinate It's just a decision somebody wants to bring them here, a business decision, I think you referred to it as. Is that okay that the taxpayers, is it common for the taxpayers to pay to send people to inspect product elsewhere before it comes into Nova Scotia? It's pretty unique, right?
Mr. Dunn?
I can't comment on whether it's a common practice. I can say it is the Department of Agriculture's responsibility to ensure that everything is done to ensure that beer importation into the province is done in a way that ensures that the small hive beetle does not get here. And I think as part of that, it would be incumbent on us and not uncommon for us to pay for that. And I would suggest that $8,000 is a very small amount to pay to ensure that the small hive beetle is not in Nova Scotia.
Okay. Is it true that if an entity wants to import hives to Nova Scotia, and they do that regularly every year, they import some. If they were not to import this year, do they never get to import again? Is there some continuity requirement on behalf of the department that you have to import them every year? Otherwise, you're probably going to lose your ability to import.
Ms. Robichaud?
No, it is an annual application process, so there's
and
no.
And each application is distinct and.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. I do want to ask about maybe a couple of yes or no questions, and I'll try to frame them as such, if that's okay. Cabbage farmers in the province feel like they're being dumped on with cabbage from areas like Ontario and Quebec that have higher subsidies. The minister did a report and analysis a couple years ago that said no. In fact, it's just that it's not to do with the subsidies. It's in fact that there's higher yields in those areas, and it's the cabbage farmers in Nova Scotia find it hard to believe that the farmers in Ontario and Quebec are just better farmers than them. So I'd just like to ask, the report that said that it has to do with yields, there is a report that exists, I'm led to believe. Is that a report that you can provide to the committee? Just
Mr. Walker,
can we get that report?
We'll go back to Mr. Dunn.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we can.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure the clerk will take note of that. Under the under the bilateral agreements in place, has the Department of Agriculture made any applications for federal infrastructure money to address the protection of Nova Scotia farmland from rising sea levels? Now, specifically, the rising sea levels threaten some of our existing dikes, and when dikes breach, it's pretty expensive. We've seen that in areas like Truro and stuff. Has any application been made for federal infrastructure money to improve the dike system in Nova Scotia? Has an application been made?
Ms. Robichaud.
Yes, under the AgriRisk program, the federal program that was launched through our land protection section in collaboration with the Nova Scotia Federation of Agriculture, we have made an application and we're successful in the first round of a multi-year program approval to address flood mitigation concerns for the province.
Okay, and so it's been approved?
It has. Year
and
one
how,
has
how
been
much
approved.
Money will that bring to Nova Scotia to address
$1
it?
$1 million in the first year.
Okay. I do want to talk about aquaculture, specifically shellfish aquaculture. You mentioned earlier that there's a third-party panel that's been established to look at aquaculture applications and amendments to existing. Is that, were you talking finfish or are you talking shellfish or are you talking both? The third-party panel.
Mr. Dunn?
Both.
Okay, and are you at liberty to say who's on that panel or how big that panel is or...
If I can remember the names, I believe Jean McKenna is the chair, and I'm looking to.
Maybe we can provide them to you.
Provide
the panel. Yes. It's an active panel. It's actually doing work already, looking at applications and stuff.
They haven't actually looked at applications yet. They've only been appointed, I think, in the last, I'm going to say, month, 2 months. And so there's a process of bringing them up to speed on the process and a bit of an education process.
So while that has happened, so no applications are being approved for shellfish aquaculture until that panel's up and running?
Mr. Osborne?
So new applications, certain applications go to the panel, and certain types of applications would go to the aquaculture administrator. So marine shellfish and finfish applications, new ones, would go to the panel.
New ones, okay. What about amendments to people who have a lease already? I'm thinking of oysters. And they're trying to amend their lease to allow them to use the Vexar bags, which are pretty necessary in their business. That would be an amendment to a lease, I guess?
That would go to the administrator, to the aquaculture administrator.
Okay, and is the administrator approving amendments, or is there still... Sometimes I hear there's a moratorium, sometimes I hear there's not a moratorium. There's kind of a moratorium. Where are we at with that? Is there a moratorium?
So the administrator is in place and doing the work that the regulations have assigned to the administrator. As an example, there's been, I think, 50 renewals under the new system. And the new renewal system, those decisions, those renewals that don't require an amendment that go to the administrator. There's been 50 of those. That's the new system that has public input, posting on the website of those sites that are to be renewed or amended. And public input is sought, and the decisions of the administrator are posted online as well. And the rationale for that decision of the administrator is posted there as well as their decision. It's on the department's website.
Okay. Our oysters are second to none. It's a premium product. And what we've seen is New Brunswick, the growth of their shellfish industry has been huge. Ours hasn't. And we got to get our act together on some of this stuff, for sure. In terms of oysters, is the department given any thought to a seed hatchery?
Mr. Osborne?
They need access to seed. And they have to get it from PEI or New Brunswick, or in many cases right now. You can't always rely on natural spat collection. So is there any discussion of a seed hatchery?
With respect to oysters and oyster seed and oyster development, there was a challenge of an oyster disease that significantly impacted the oyster industry in Nova Scotia. So to rebuild that sector, one of the things is to address that disease and work on disease-resistant strains of oyster. So we've been focusing a lot of work in that area to make sure that the seed that we would then use will survive and grow, and we can carry on and rebuild the industry. There have been discussions around a hatchery. I can't say that I have that we're looking at a particular proposal for a hatchery. It is something that is a private sector interest.
Is there programs
primarily
available? Would there be any funding available that you can think of, like even through a federal program, to establish a hatchery in Nova Scotia?
So right now, we have an aquaculture R&D fund of $2 million, and we're using that fund to address those strategic bottleneck issues for species. Oysters is one of our priority focus species in the province for shellfish.
Order. Time has expired. We'll move back to the NDP caucus. And Ms. Zan.
Thank you. Great to see you all here today. Thank you very much for answering our questions. The current government has been talking about working with the industry stakeholders in agriculture to create a provincial agricultural land preservation plan. To be complemented with easements through an agriculture land trust. So could you please provide us with an update on this?
We'll go with Mr. Walker.
So we've been working with both the Nova Scotia Federation of Agriculture and the Annapolis Valley Land Trust down the valley, and there's currently a committee that's been struck to look at some recommendations that came out of an internal report that we put together.
And so when was the board meeting, and who was at the board meeting, did you say?
So the committee that prepared the report included the Federation of Agriculture, the Annapolis Valley Land Trust, and representatives from the department.
Right. And when was that?
The report was done last year, and so the follow-up to the report is to bring together a working group with the Federation of Agriculture to examine the options and recommendations in that report.
Okay, and so when is the working group going to be going ahead, did you say?
So the terms of reference has just been created, so we expect in the next month or so that that committee will come together.
So we'll be hearing more over the next month about...
Yes.
When they're going to meet. And is this going to be an ongoing process for like a year or for a few months? Or what are you foreseeing?
I would anticipate. I mean, there's been a lot of work done in this area. So, and there's some fairly good recommendations in the internal report that was done. So I wouldn't expect it to be too long a process.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that last part.
Sorry, it wouldn't be too long a process. So I wouldn't say more than a year.
Okay, so approximately over a year, though?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Also, during the NDP's time in government, I remember that we were all very proud that we were the only province in Canada to keep increasing farms here, as opposed to the other provinces. So the current government has promised to work with stakeholders to create a strategic plan that would increase the number of new farmers entering the industry. So can you give us an update on that strategic plan and provide us with some numbers, specific numbers, about how many new farmers have entered the industry in Nova Scotia since 2013 when the government took office?
Ms. Robichaud?
Thank you. I'll have to get you the exact number on the increase. We were the only province trending, as you're aware, with an increase in farm numbers, kind of balking the trend across the country.
Yeah.
Our initiatives still continue under Farm Next and Think Farm in the current policy framework with our federal partners. And under our next policy framework, we will look at what the evolution of the Think Farm program will look like. But that will feed into the strategy, and our efforts continue to increase farm numbers. We've just completed work around barriers to growth for the 60% of our farms that are below the income threshold to actually generate an income that would be sustainable long term. So that will feed into that work as well. So I'll get those numbers for you. I don't have them today, but they would not be as high as they were when we were trending upwards. I do know that.
Yeah. So is there a plan to try and increase the numbers still and get more people coming from Europe, for instance, starting farms? I know that part of the program was to try and attract young families who want to get into the farming business, because a lot of the new generation aren't necessarily wanting to take their parents' farms.
Exactly. That's part of the barriers to growth determination on why are they not willing to take the farms. But yes, the initiatives do still continue under Think Farm and our partners on attracting new farmers to Nova Scotia, not only internationally, but from other parts of the country. So those efforts continue, and we have interprovincial discussions around attraction as well. Wine has been a good area where we've attracted new entrants into farming as it relates to grape production. So that would just be one example.
That's good. And are there any? Is there anything in place right now to help with the transitions over from the one generation to the next for taking on the farm?
Yes, successional planning has been an issue for young farmers wanting to take over operations.
Yes.
And we've worked very diligently with the Federation of Agriculture housed in Truro to come up with workshops and initiatives and provide coaching and counseling around the legal requirements to make that happen. So it's been very positive. There's been a lot of attendance at these workshops and sessions. And dialogue is continuing around how we might be able to make that something that's more accessible, whether it's a live module where you go for information or a live session. So it is recognized as one of those barriers, but there's been tremendous work taking place.
Good. Glad to hear that. Thank you. I'll be looking forward to seeing what is the outcome of that. I know one of my colleagues had asked about bees, but I'd also like to just follow up on that. I'd been hearing from the Nova Scotia Beekeepers Association that they have been actually pressing the department, the agricultural department, to not issue importation permits for beehives from Ontario because of the small hive beetle threat or the varroa mite, which is a huge colony disorder. It's very dangerous for the bees and kills all the worker bees over winter, as you probably know, and over the fall while they're hibernating, just leaving the queen with a bunch of honey and no workers. So the president of the Nova Scotia Beekeepers Association says that she was actually informed by the department that a permit will be issued for one truckload of bees from Ontario. So she has actually said that this is going to happen, she was told. So can you confirm if that's correct? And if so, could you please explain the rationale for allowing this one truckload of those bees?
The application is in. The actual issuance of the permit has not taken place. So there is nothing currently that would prevent that from happening, to answer your question. But they are not in possession of the permit currently. To address the notion of small hive beetle and the concern raised by the Beekeepers Association, the minister did commission a study to assess the risk of introduction of small hive beetle if the border remained open into Nova Scotia and permits continued to be issued. We had the results of that scientific study completed and presented to all interested stakeholders and parties, which assessed the risk of being low for the introduction of small hive beetle into the province. In addition, we released new protocol for 2017 with heightened requirements on inspection before any truckloads could or hives could be brought in via truckload into the province. So we're also demonstrating increased due diligence on inspection protocol, and 100% of all hives coming into the province will be inspected. The other actually really nice part about the partnership on this is last year and again this year, we had parties join the inspection team from industry so that they could also learn and be educated on what small hive beetle actually looks like, because we don't have it here and they've never seen it. So there was an educational component and demonstrated the commitment of government to take those individuals with us to Ontario to do those inspections. So lots of effort is taking place both on extension and on mitigation of the potential for the small hive beetle to be introduced.
So my question would be, since there already is this small hive beetle or the varroa mite, as it's called, varroa destructor, in existence in Ontario, why are we even considering trucking in any bees from Ontario at this point in time? Why don't we, if we're going to have to bring some in, why not bring them in from somewhere else where that beetle is not even a problem? Because it's so dangerous. It can wipe out an entire bee colony in a very short amount of time. And although we may have, as you, I think I heard you say earlier, that we may have enough bees for this season, I don't know why we would actually take that chance. It's the same with beef. When there seems to be a beef disease, that people don't bring in beef from that province. So why are we considering bringing them in and spending the money to check them out instead of just bringing in bees from somewhere else?
This is a business relationship with Ontario that's been in existence for a number of years. They're a very good province to work with. It is unfortunate that they do have regions that are positive for small hive beetle currently, but it is also a business transaction on where the bees come in from or the hives come in. And Ontario has a system in place where we can work very collaboratively with their inspectors on the ground. It's not every province that would accommodate Nova Scotia's request to fly in people, to go on every farm, to reinspect what Ontario inspectors have already inspected. And they're very accommodating in that light. Not all provinces would be that receptive, and nor are all provinces in a position that they are also small hive beetle, that there is no detection of small hive beetle. So there's really various components to it, But there's also a relationship and an establishment of working very closely to the benefit of the industry here on allowing us to come in and inspect at our own standards.
Okay, thank you. The other thing I wanted to mention when it comes to bees is also glyphosate and the fact that glyphosate, many people are concerned about its effect on our pollinators. And last year, the Environment Department allowed for a lot of spraying to be done by the forestry industry here in Nova Scotia, which people were very concerned about, killing off bee populations and also making them sick. And in America, they've done, they have shown, statistics show that honey now coming from the United States, when they test it, it's actually full of glyphosate. So a number of beekeepers here in Nova Scotia have been talking to me about the fact that they are concerned about their bees and their bees flying out into the lands that have been sprayed. And a number of beekeepers have said that they are making an effort to put their bees on lands that are nowhere near anything that is being sprayed, and they are advertising their honey as such. So along with that idea, I'm also hearing that there is genetically modified alfalfa seeds that are going to be coming here for sale in Nova Scotia. And I asked Minister Colwell that question last year in the spring about whether or not we were going to be having these genetically modified alfalfa seeds coming to Nova Scotia, and he didn't know the answer at that time. But the National Farmers Union has protested against the introduction of these GMO seeds here in Canada. So have you received any feedback yet from, A, the beekeepers about their concerns about glyphosate spraying, and also have you heard any feedback from farmers in Nova Scotia about the introduction of genetically modified seeds?
Mr. Dunn, you have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through you, on the glyphosate issue, I think it's important to for folks in the room to know that glyphosate is approved by the federal government and is approved as...
Yes. However, I'm sorry to interrupt you just because we don't have much time, but the World Health Organization has deemed it a carcinogenic, a probable carcinogen, and they've reiterated that just recently. So there are varying reports out there, and people are very, very concerned.
Would you like to finish your comments there before we move to the Liberal caucus?
Mr.
Dunn.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Ms. Lones-Croft, for 14 minutes.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here today. I'm going to switch the theme a little bit here because being a rural MLA, I like to talk about some of the things going on in my constituency. And you know, I have the 103 in my constituency, and if you're driving down it, you see these beautiful big blue signs, ones, you know, speaking to the great tourism of Mahone Bay and Lunenburg and home of the Blue Nose. But I want to speak to another big blue sign, which is the Lunenburg County Balsam for Christmas Tree Capital of the World. And that's not a message that I've heard here. They are great exporters in our province. And over the years, they've had their ups and downs. Recently, I think they've seen a bit of a turn, which is very positive. I just recently attended the Lunenburg County Christmas Tree Growers Spring Technical session, and I was really pleased to see how far the Smart Tree Program has come here in Nova Scotia. And I'd like you to speak to the project, its success, and its timelines, because I understand we're ready for these seedlings in 2 years.
Mr. Dunn.
So maybe I'll start, Mr. Chair, and then turn it over perhaps to Ms. Robichaud. So for those that don't know, the Smart Tree Project is a project that involves both the Christmas Tree Association, so industry and government and academia, to do research to develop a Christmas tree that basically holds its needles for a longer period of time. And in this particular case, we're looking at something around 90 days. Christmas trees are a big industry in Nova Scotia, and particularly in certain ridings in Nova Scotia. I can give you an example. I was in Louisiana shortly after Christmas this year, and there was a number of Christmas trees that were out by the wayside to be picked up by the local garbage collection. And I asked some questions, and I come to find out that the Christmas trees that were in Louisiana were actually Christmas trees from Nova Scotia. They were somewhat brown, so obviously we hadn't got to the smart tree incidents yet. But it's an important development because a lot of our Christmas tree exports go to places where folks normally would not expect Christmas trees to grow. I mean, we export our trees obviously to the U.S., but we export them to the Caribbean, to the Bahamas, to a number of southern jurisdictions. So obviously, if you can grow a Christmas tree that retains its green needles longer, when we're shipping them, in some cases in October, November, it's another example of a premium product from Nova Scotia. So around the specific details, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Robichaud, which will add some more comment.
Mr. Robichaud.
Thank you.
Sorry, Ms. Robichaud.
That's okay. Christmas trees have not really been that long under a commodity group with agriculture, and I can remember working quite closely with them, it's got to be within the last decade, over getting recognition that this is a very valuable crop that is produced and harvested and sold much like any other agricultural crop. And in that vein, we had decided then that we would support the Christmas Tree Association, not only with some initial investment on formalizing the association, but also with getting recognition through our Federation of Agriculture as a commodity in agriculture. And when that happened, it was really around the same time that the research was really getting underway for this project. And the facility at the Agritech Park in Bible Hill was retooled to actually house Dr. Latta at the time and his team. To undertake this research. They had four very active labs. They still have four very active labs on site there currently. I had the opportunity to tour them just a couple of weeks ago. But the work is tremendous, and the research is demonstrating that they've really revitalized that industry in terms of competition from artificial trees by ensuring that the needles could stay on longer and be exported earlier and still meet the Christmas timeline for that project. We also recognize the importance of Christmas tree production by the recognition through being a commodity in agriculture that it opened up the door for them in terms of accessing federal and provincial dollars through our policy framework. So they have been fortunate as well through that relationship with agriculture to have access to marketing programs and different programs that help support the development and marketing and market access of that industry. The timelines for the project I don't have exactly with me today. You raised that question. I can certainly get that for you. But I also want to indicate that there's a tremendous working relationship there as well with Dow Lacey in collaboration with the Christmas Tree Association and the Department of Agriculture. And wanted to mention that because it's very important that the research continue in that particular area for the longevity of that industry.
Can you speak a bit more to the partnership with the Lunenburg County Christmas Tree Growers Association? I understand that they really grasp the goals of the Ivany Report, and they're a great example. We're always hearing nothing's being done with the Ivany Report, or it's not meeting its goals. But here, you know, the partnership that these farmers have made with the Agricultural College, Dr. Roche. Could you speak to the investment that the Lunenburg County growers have made?
I'm not aware of the dollar value of the investment, but I understand that there was a very creative and innovative way of generating revenue to continue on with research. that had, and again, I don't want to misquote myself, but each member contributing a certain percentage towards the work carrying on, which would be reflective of industry and government and academia partnering to the betterment of the Christmas Tree Association and industry overall. I don't know the exact dollar value of the investment, but I do understand it was substantial.
Yes, and I understand that they sold shares within their group and beyond. I believe shares went for about $500 a piece. I saw a presentation of two smart trees to the two big sellers who were farmers who have sold the most shares. And there was some talk that each plant was worth so many million dollars because of the investment. But, you know, this speaks well to our industry, and we're really hoping that it will move it forward. We, you know, take pride. I mean, we started the Tree to Boston program in 1970, sending the first tree down to begin that tradition, and I hope at the 100th anniversary, the Lunenburg County Christmas Tree Growers Association will be front and center with the Christmas tree that will go to Boston this year. I'd like to talk about, we also had another great event, which your department was involved in on the weekend, Agriculture Day. And where we've heard some that small farms aren't being bought up, but I can tell you on the South Shore, small farms are being bought up. Not, you know, families aren't traditionally taking them over like they did, but we're getting a lot of people coming to Lunenburg County, having small farms. We see a big increase in local farm markets where people want to buy products. And we had Agriculture Day. Perennia was front and center, offering so many resources to people and there to answer questions. One of our other big success stories is Lehigh Farms and with the Hascat Berry. And this is a wonderful story about foreign investors. And they have brought in many, many people to Nova Scotia and have encouraged other people from Nova Scotia to buy plants, plant Hascat. Can you speak about the success of the Hascat Berry and what it means for other people coming into Nova Scotia and investing?
Hascap is a real success story. When Hascap first came here, there was certainly a lot of workshops and dialogue at the time to determine, was this actually a berry that could be produced here because its native roots are not from here, very different than a wild blueberry. And the department invested quite heavily and worked very much collaboratively with the investors at the time to demonstrate that it was a viable crop, that it could be produced here. And there was a lot of spin-offs of that because the model is a little bit different in that there's grower members that feed into somewhat of a co-op model for Hascap. But the real success story I find in addition to the grower model that was developed was the partnership that came from that with Dal AC on the nutraceutical side of Hascap. So not only were you producing a crop, value-adding it for your jams and your jellies and all of the great things that they produce, but they also, we worked jointly with them to secure some funding for research at the Dal AC campus on potential nutraceutical values of the derivatives from Hascap. So that in of itself is another stream of revenue potentially for that crop, very much value added, taking it into a little bit of a different realm than agriculture, but demonstrates that there are real possibilities with a crop that go beyond value adding simply on the agricultural side, that there can be other uses as well. So yes, a real success story. And we continue to work with them as well through our Select by Local initiative and do lots of features with the Hascap growers and the products and how they can be used.
And on Tuesday, there was an announcement about improvements to rural internet, which I hear about frequently from and hear the Hascap farm is an example of that, where they had to really, because of their need for high-speed internet, they had to move their main operation into Mahone Bay, where they could get fiber up and really run their, a lot of their owners live in England and other countries, and you know, communication is vital, and plus connecting with buyers and sellers. So this announcement to improve rural internet is going to really help the various industries, especially the agriculture industries. We're seeing small farms popping up and small businesses. And I get daily calls about the lack of internet and the slow internet. So how do you see announcements like this and the use of internet as building on the agriculture that you already have?
Mr. Chair, through you. So, you know, the internet is a perfect example of a tool, a technology that all our industries can use, both in agriculture and the seafood sector, to grow our markets. And you know, innovation is an important thing, and you know, innovation comes in many forms. But I would argue, you know, at its basic form, fiber op or internet for companies in rural Nova Scotia is an innovation that we need, and I believe it has been said that internet access in rural areas is as much a right as anything to help grow the economy. So I think it's a great thing for particularly our rural areas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I noticed many of our farmers have to make communications through the night when there aren't as many users on it. And sometimes Dr. Roche, who's been working on the smart tree, has responded immediately. So he's up in the middle of the night doing some of his work on the smart tree. And I think I've run out of time.
Yes, order. You. Time is just about expired. Thank you very much. And thank you to our witnesses. Mr. Dunn, allow you to make some closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very quickly just want to thank the committee members today for questions on both the seafood and agriculture sector, and encourage everyone in the room to promote Nova Scotia products, whether it be in Nova Scotia, Canada, or across the country. We have a lot to be proud of, so thank you very much.
Thank you. We do have some committee business. We have received some correspondence. I will go through them piece by piece. If there are any comments or questions, just let me know. The first is from Department of Municipal Affairs. This was information requested from the March 1st meeting. And that was on equipment for the emergency first responders, emergency services provider fund. So are there any questions on that? Hearing none. Moving to Department of Justice correspondence, and this was additional information related to the Fisher Maritime Consulting Report. Any questions on that? Hearing none. We'll move to Department of Transportation Infrastructure Renewal. There was a request for information. This was related to a meeting on February the 8th about Blue Nose 2, and the department has requested a two-week extension to respond to both questions that were outstanding. Just bring that to the committee's awareness as it is correspondence. Any questions or comments? No? Okay. And we have a request for clarification, and I don't believe committee members have seen this, so I'm just going to read it very quickly. This was a request for information from the Department of Health and Wellness, and the question that had been asked was, how much has the province paid to other jurisdictions in transfer payments to cover the cost of Nova Scotians going to other areas to get treatment? And how much has Nova Scotia received from other provinces in return for services offered to people visiting our province? The follow-up from Health, they've come back to us, and they said that the information we collected was specific to physicians. But we were asked to see if the panel wanted information related as well to hospitals. So they have the information related to physicians. The question being asked of the committee is, would you like to see information related to hospitals as well, or is physicians sufficient? Okay, Mr. Houston?
Yeah, I think we should get it at the hospital level as well.
Okay, any other questions or comment? Hearing none, we'll ask our clerk to carry that response back to the Department of Health and Wellness. Our next meeting is scheduled for April 5th. It is with Department of Health and Wellness, and that is to discuss Emergency Department Accountability and Collaborative Emergency Centers. Is there any other further business to come before the committee? Mr. Houston and then Ms. Zan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the schedule. I believe we have an opening on April 26th. It's an open day. We have meetings before that, and we have meetings after that. And I'd hate to see the committee miss a week just because of scheduling problems. So I'd like to propose that we fill that week. I'd like to propose that we fill that week. We ask Engage Nova Scotia to come before the committee. So I'd like to make a motion this morning. Mr. Chair, I move that Danny Graham, in his capacity of Chief Engagement Officer with Engage Nova Scotia, appear before the Public Accounts Committee, along with the appropriate staff from Communities, Cultures, and Heritage, at the earliest opportunity, which would be April 26. So I'd like to make that motion that the committee invite Danny Graham to appear before the Public Accounts Committee on April 26.
Mr. Rankin.
Yes, the standard practice of the committee is to set your items forward, put your items forward during agenda setting. We did go around that and for the same party, the Progressive Conservative Party, in the last time because they said it constituted an emergency. So we allowed the Blue Nose to come forward as a topic, and they took away one of their items in the last agenda setting. I don't see any emergency why we would circumvent this standard practice of this committee. That party has an opportunity to put forward items as the other two parties do in the next agenda setting, so I won't support any motion that circumvents the standard practice of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Rankin. Mr. Houston.
Thank you. I understand Mr. Rankin's concern about the scheduling and which topics go forward, and this is not about that. I'd be happy to change a topic down the road like we did with the Blue Nose, and it's not an emergency either. I concede on both of those points. But we have a committee that has a mandate to meet and discuss the matters of public funds in this province. We have an open date. I don't see any reason why this committee should just take a week off when we have an opportunity to schedule a business of the province. And so I would just suggest that we have an open date. Let's fill it, and let's not get hung up on the red tape of when things are asked. It's almost a month away. Let's fill it.
Do I have permission for the committee to extend its time past 11 a.m.? Okay, I'm not hearing consensus on that. So we have just a minute left. There has been a motion put forward. All those in favor. We have 1 minute left. There has been a motion put forth to call Engage Nova Scotia. Mr. Rankin.
And again, so just say that it's not an emergency. What gives one party the right to pick the topic out of the three? Like, what's stopping me from saying, okay, I want to bring in a different department to fill that topic then?
Suggest your topic then.
The point is, the parties in this legislature are equal in terms of who puts forward the topics. We went around that process the last time. We accommodated the Progressive Conservative Caucus for their item based on it being an emergency. I'm not willing to play political games just so we can fill a day that's missing, that's a few weeks out, and expect that we can arrange for our clerks to bring in a witness into the committee.
Thank you. And with that, with there's just seconds remaining, I now call this meeting is now adjourned because we have run out of time. This meeting is adjourned.